From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a big federal indictment hits Fiat Chrysler and the UAW.
And they've never seen any. They can't remember anything like this. The UAW, I think, is stunned.
Amazon's footprint in Michigan is growing with the help of the state.
Amazon needs those warehouses in order to fulfill its vision. It's going to locate in these places anyway. Why are we giving them public tax dollars?
We meet actors from the new movie Detroit about the Algiers Motel murders during the 67 uprising.
It's a moment in history that so much was going on. Everybody felt like they had to be heard and they weren't heard.
Every day was tough on set, but we held each other up as a cast. We prayed every day before the scenes. We made sure we told each other we loved each other after every scene because we knew how serious this was.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With the multi-billion dollar online retailer giant Amazon coming to multiple Michigan cities, a researcher asks, why do they need tax breaks? That story later this hour. But first, U.S. automakers reported their second quarter earnings this week. Who's up, who's down, and how are the companies preparing for the future? Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. First off, who's smiling, Daniel, and who is not with these earnings reports?
Well, I think Fiat Chrysler out today has reason to smile. I mean, they had record numbers. Their margins are going up, both corporate-wide around the world and also in North America. And they're doing it at a time when they're changing over a lot of product inside the Jeep portfolio and other things. I think this also speaks to the fact that what's happening in the marketplace as demand for cars continues to decline and SUVs and pickups go up, that's a good thing because the mix, as they say in the business, gets richer. And that is shown on the bottom line. And these companies, all three of them, are showing that.
It wasn't a great report for General Motors.
Well, no. I mean, they're unwinding. You know, they're selling
mm-hmm.
Europe.
Yeah.
They're unwinding a lot of things. They're getting out of India. They're getting out of South Africa. So that's having a drag on their numbers in this quarter. But I look at a couple of numbers with these companies, particularly General Motors. Well, all of them. And what are the margins you're doing? What I can remember covering General Motors in the 90s when all they wanted to do was get to a 5% margin in North America. This last quarter, they were at 12. I mean, that is really kind of unheard of. You're starting to get into luxury vehicle kind of luxury makers. That's always been the differentiator between the Detroit companies and, say, the German companies, because if you're selling Mercedes and you're selling BMW brands, you're selling a premium product and you price for it in the marketplace and you don't put a lot of incentives on the – and if people want to buy it, they're going to pay. And you're starting to see now that the American companies are gearing in a way that they're starting to get into – the kind of margins that you start to see in luxury brands. I mean, FCA is an example. Their Maserati brand, the Italian sport sedan, they're about 14.2, which is, kind of gives you a sense as to the direction that they're going. So I'm always looking at that. I think it's a real important indicator, and it's really important for them as they're trying to build their credibility on Wall Street, which, as we've talked many times, is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, and as you write about in today's news, you say, old Detroit, it's not. You talk about the new Detroit discipline.
Yep, I think that's exactly right. I mean, you're seeing them cutting shifts, laying off at least temporary layoffs, offering some white-collar buyouts at a time when they're still in really, really record territory. We're just down a little bit from all-time record highs. So it's not like we're in a real slowdown here. Things are changing and softening, but we're certainly not in anything close to a panic kind of mode.
Now, the biggest news, though, you know, earnings reports flying around and all of that, but the biggest news this week is not about financial reports. Let's talk about these indictments that we've learned about.
It's a different kind of money. It is stunning. You have the former vice president of labor relations for FCA and the wife of a recently deceased vice president of the United Auto Workers indicted by federal authorities for just unbelievable kind of financial enrichment. What they were doing is using monies that are joint monies that are at the Chrysler or the FCA National Training Center and essentially siphoning them off for their own personal use for paying off student loans and doing landscaping and putting in a pool and buying clothes and cars. And it's unbelievable. I talked to a couple of people who have been around this town a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never seen any. They can't remember anything like this. The UAW, I think, is stunned. This is a union that has prided itself going back to the end of World War II, if not before, of being a clean union, of making sure that they don't have pots of money that can entice people. Mm-hmm. They professionally manage it. They've always insisted on the companies managing a lot of those funds that they put together. And these funds, it's important to note here, it's not dues money from union members. It is monies that are negotiated every time they negotiate a contract and the company says, okay, here's your budget, and you have essentially authority to spend up to X. And if you spend it, we'll write the checks. If you don't spend it, fine. But that's how it works. So really this money is originated in the coffers of Fiat Chrysler, not in the dues base of the UAW.
Now, these are indictments and certainly not yet convictions, but what do you think it means? What kind of long-range impact might it have on the union?
You know, I suspect not very much. This was something that is unusual for them. My sense is, in talking to some well-placed sources, that they take this with the utmost seriousness. They are cooperating fully with the feds. They are doing their own investigation. They don't want to get out in front of the federal investigation or do something that could cause a problem or mess it up or slow it down or anything like that. My read of these guys and of President Dennis Williams is they take this deadly serious and they will do whatever they need to do to root this kind of thing out. They have a very specific ethics policy that addresses issues like this. And they have a reputation of trying to live cleaner. I mean, the two great Detroit unions, the Teamsters and the United Auto Workers, on issues like this couldn't be more different. Of course, mm-hmm. the Teamsters, as people who watch their mob movies know,
sure.
Got very much into using pension funds to help build Las Vegas and got into a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the UAW has always kind of seen themselves as different and really the polar opposite of that. And this is just going to stiffen their resolve.
Do we see any potential rippling effect at Fiat Chrysler?
Well, there have been some other names or people who are identified but not named, if you understand my mm-hmm. point, that appear to work in employee relations. So there may be some other things that come out of this. I suspect, and I think some of the people who are more savvy legally about this than I am, their suspicion is that this is probably not over and that there will be additional charges brought against additional people.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
In the wake of Detroit's 1967 rebellion and similar unrest nationwide, a group called the Kerner Commission dug into the underlying causes. Their main finding? America was heading toward two separate unequal societies, one white, one black, and one of the deepest inequalities was in education. In the late 60s, a new Detroit program in Detroit schools tried to address these inequalities. It showed tremendous promise and then ended abruptly. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick talked with someone who taught in that program, someone she knows very well.
My name is Teresa Luxmore, and I was a teacher for Detroit Public Schools for 35 years.
But to me, she's Aunt Teresa. Actually, she's my great aunt. When I was little, I remember she always talked about her kids. It took me a while to figure out she meant her students. These were kids from some of the toughest neighborhoods on Detroit's east side.
They were pretty much enjoyable. They found, by and large, they tickled me more than they were hard to get along with.
My Aunt Teresa started teaching elementary school in the early 1960s. After 1967, the Detroit Public Schools became a battleground for the city's growing racial polarization. The district faced a problem: how to guarantee its growing African-American student population a truly equal education in the face of mounting neighborhood decay and growing white resentment. There were lots of competing theories and contentious opinions, and some new experimental programs emerged in Detroit schools. One of them was called the Neighborhood Educational Center. It launched in 1968 with a $6 million federal grant. It ran in six neighborhood schools on the city's east side. Teachers had to apply for the program.
Because the premise was to establish smaller class sizes and have a new type of evaluation so that we were really stressing how students learn rather than how teachers teach.
And that meant lots of ongoing year-round learning for the teachers, too. The program centered around clusters in each grade, four teachers and about 66 students per cluster. There were some major guiding principles, along with regular oversight and feedback, but the teachers also had lots of freedom in the classroom.
Sometimes we'd work in small groups. Sometimes we'd put all the students together and had a big project. Each cluster did it a different way.
Setting long-range goals for students and teachers was a big theme. So was defining and measuring learning with regular tests. But for the most part, teacher clusters got to design their own tests and use them in individualized ways to measure a student's progress. and they could give students lots of independence.
We created games that fit the tests, and we created learning centers. We had folders that may have had worksheets.
My Aunt Teresa says it took some figuring out as they went along, but it seemed to work.
The people who pretty much adhered to giving the test when the students first came in, if you did that and were diligent about that, they seemed to do pretty well. There was a lot of growth.
NEC students took the regular standardized test, too. Outside researchers validated the results.
Do you remember, for your cluster, what the results were?
Of course. They did very well. We had some students who didn't move a lot, but we had, and I can even remember some of their names, that when we received them in the fourth grade, they may have been reading at 3.1 level in the fourth grade, and they left maybe reading 6.2.
In other words, they went from reading below grade level to above grade level. Three stick out in my Aunt Teresa's memory.
Marlon McDay, Maurice Wooford, Norman Chapman. They grew so much. That was probably the biggest thing. You know, they came in with lower test scores, but you knew they had something on the ball because just the way they interacted with you.
The program had a mix of kids, predominantly Black, but not exclusively. My Aunt Teresa says their home lives ran the gamut from solid middle class to deep poverty.
Some of them, you could tell that they were very well cared for, and others you could see were terribly disadvantaged. And, you know, we might have to send them down with a bar of soap and clean up in the morning.
Almost from the start, the Neighborhood Educational Center program was hailed as a success. The American Institutes of Research said in its three-year review, the NEC project incorporates most, if not all, of the features which characterize successful programs. The researchers recommended that Detroit Public Schools continue the NEC, and it did for another 2 years. But after that,
all the funds were gone. And the board said, you know, we can't take away from the other students. You know, that means we'd have to pull their money away from the other schools, and we can't afford to do that.
And with that, a model educational program, one that showed real success helping some of the most disadvantaged kids learn in the aftermath of Detroit's violent upheaval, was simply allowed to die. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision. Creation.
The next idea.
You need to tell a story.
Baseball and opera usually don't end up in the same sentence, but for the next year, they will in Detroit. That's thanks to a partnership between the Michigan Opera Theater and the Detroit Tigers. Take Me Out to the Opera will explore the way arts and sports bring people together, especially across racial lines. The effort includes community activities and classroom opportunities for Detroit students and will culminate with a production of an opera about baseball. Here to tell us more now is Wayne Brown, the CEO of the Michigan Opera Theater. Wayne, welcome. It's so good to have you with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
I got to say, I think to most people I know, it hit me like baseball and opera is an unusual combination. Who was the first to connect the two?
Well, I suspect it may come down to the composer, Daniel Sonnenberg, who first came up with the notion of a baseball and opera. From the point of view of looking at a very important, significant American sport, and the fact that as a composer of classical music and also a big fan of baseball, he said to himself, why not combine the two for so that all Americans can fully appreciate these distinctive parts of our lives which affect so many.
And, of course, we're talking about Daniel Sonnenberg, the composer of The Summer King, which we're going to talk about in a bit. So how did you and the Detroit Tigers say, let's join forces here in Detroit?
Actually, I had a chance to attend the premiere of the work, which was, this is a co-presentation, in other words, with Pittsburgh Opera. And I attended the premiere in Pittsburgh, based on the life of Josh Gibson. And it was an opportunity to see how that connection would take place between the sports team as well as the opera company. And so I said, well, we should try and think about doing that here in Detroit, making those same ties between Michigan Opera Theater and also the Detroit Tigers, which perform at Comerica Park. And that, perhaps another aspect of that connection has to do with the fact that our respective headquarters are within 1,000 feet of each other.
They are indeed.
As I'm talking with you at this very moment, I'm looking at home plate. And so that connection takes on really tangible form for us and not just theoretical.
So what will this Take Me Out to the Opera partnership involve?
Well, I think it would be a number of issues. Number one, I think it's important to underscore that one of the things that Michigan Opera Theater is concerned about and dedicated to is in community engagement. The nature of what we do is for the benefit of our community. And as we know, that there are communities within communities, within our great community. And so I think it will allow us to use the opera art form as a way to convey stories, conveying an important story about arts and sports. So there will be a series of partners in addition to Detroit Tigers, including the Charles Wright Museum and the Detroit Historical Society, Detroit Public Library, the Josh Gibson Foundation, and along with Hamtramck Stadium and the Rosedale Park Community House, all designed to say we as a community consist of various experiences and aspects of life throughout the greater Detroit area, and we want to bring them together through this opera work that will be celebration of baseball.
And what would the Tigers be bringing to this effort?
The Tigers have committed themselves to join forces to us in a very significant way. There will be featured special elements will occur in Detroit Tigers publications. This will be an opportunity to expose youth and baseball players involved in the Detroit Tigers Play Baseball Detroit Initiative to the arts. It will also include performances and lectures at various locations that the Tigers have joined forces in helping to make happen. It will include a number of members of the Detroit Tigers, both players and those involved in the front office, who will join us for a special occasion throughout the year.
So this really very much is collaborative. And I know going into the schools in Detroit is a big part of this. And do I understand, I was looking at the MichiganOperaTheater.org website, that that there will actually be residencies at Detroit schools where kids will be creating their own opera?
There will be residencies in Detroit schools. And it will also provide an opportunity for kids to be able to create their own works which relate to the history of the Detroit Negro League baseball team, the Detroit Stars, with modern-day themes of equity and inclusion. One of the things that this collaboration will allow us to do is focus on the importance of healing and of diverse experiences and being able to make sure that we constantly remain aware and work toward an inclusive and respectful community environment. And so through this project with the Detroit Tigers, we are just so excited to be able to extend this important work. So the arts and sports will play, we believe, an important part of improving race relations and something that we should all be concerned about and invested in to make sure that we grow as a community.
Let's get a sense of what's going to be happening next May when the Michigan Opera Theater produces Daniel Sonnenberg's The Summer King. And again, this is an opera about Negro Leagues baseball player Josh Gibson, who played for the Pittsburgh Crawfords and the Homestead Grays. And here's a clip of that production that you referenced, Wayne Brown. This was put on by the Pittsburgh Opera. And this is Pittsburgh Courier reporter Wendell Smith encouraging Josh Gibson to try and break Major League Baseball's color barrier, telling his own story of being passed over by a scout for an inferior player who was white.
I pitched my final game for West Virginia State. A pitcher, Roddy Big Nine.
Again, for a lot of people, what an interesting combination, baseball and opera, which reminds us that opera is very much something that can be part of current life, that it isn't just back in 17th or 18th century Europe, that this can be part of life in our America.
That is absolutely true, and it's all part of an initiative that was launched 3 years ago called Opera of Our Time. It's a project that's been supported by key community leaders that have helped us to make that bring that message alive. It follows a series of things that we've been doing over the last few years, and we're really excited about being able to convey that message more broadly. As we think about the fact that there were figures like Jackie Robinson, who was the first African-American to play in Major League Baseball, coming out of the National Negro Leagues, or if we think about Marian Anderson, who was the first black performer to sing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, as trailblazers, we are able to think about the advancements we've made as a community, as a society. And as it turns out, Josh Gibson could very well have been the next Jackie Robinson. And it was just a matter of, at that particular time, there was one individual who was going to be able to make that initial step. And so we will try to chronicle the timeline and significant events that have taken place over the years. As it turns out, our conductor for the performance, Stephen Mercurio, is an avid baseball lover. And in fact, when he's not on the podium, when he's in Detroit conducting Michigan Opera Theater during the season, he can very well be seen and sitting in various parts of Comerica Park taking full advantage of the Detroit Tigers. So we have a strong investment here in terms of bringing the themes together, but also bringing together people who might not ordinarily think about one in the same sentence. So Take Me Out to the Opera is one that we hope captures that connection between opera and baseball.
Take Me Out to the Opera. You can follow the progress of this unique partnership and between the Detroit Tigers and the Michigan Opera Theater, see the events that are coming up and just kind of follow what's going on through this year to come by going to the website, michiganopera.org. Wayne Brown is the CEO of the Michigan Opera Theater. Wayne, thank you so very much for being with us and being a part of The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The Detroit Rebellion erupted on a Sunday morning in July 1967, just blocks away from the Catholic Church and School of St. Agnes, located on 12th Street, now known as Rosa Parks Boulevard. The parish had been a strong presence in the neighborhood for years, with a church and high school and grade school staffed by nuns, the Sisters Servants of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, sometimes known as IHMs. The order is noted for its strong commitment to social justice and education. In the 1960s and 50s, there were over 800 IHMs teaching at 32 schools in Detroit. Among them, Sister Teresa Milne, then called Sister Marius. She was the principal of St. Agnes School. And Sister Marianne Markle, then called Sister John Andrew. She'd been studying for the summer at Mary Grove College in Northwest Detroit. When the trouble erupted, Sister Marianne headed straight to St. Agnes to help the neighbors. Both women are now in retirement at the IHM Mother House in Monroe. Sister Teresa is 94 and marking her 75th year as an IHM. But the memories are clear as ever, including the way the people who lived around St. Agnes joined together to protect the parish and the firefighters who were battling the blazes on 12th Street.
There was a man with a great big rock in his hand, ready to throw it through the rose window of St. Agnes Church, which is magnificent. And this man grabbed his arm, and he said, "Don't you dare touch our church. Don't you dare." And he didn't. And then the firemen were putting out fires nearby. Our parishioners went and said, "Look, they're going to be throwing rocks at you. Let us teach us how to man these hoses, and we will put the fires out for you."
Sister Marianne Markle remembers driving from Northwest Detroit to St. Agnes.
Driving down was such a sight to see tanks in the street and armed men. It was pretty shocking. I just wondered what was happening to the city. What would the effects of this be? How are we going to deal with it?
And a lesson to last a lifetime in the neighborhood relief effort at the church.
What I remember about being down at St. Agnes is people were coming through the line, and some people would take a lot of clothes and some would take a little. We had made some comment to one of the women, like, "How do you know? Are we supposed to monitor what we're giving them?" And her comment to me was one that I'll never forget. She said, "The people who are in need will only take what they need because they know somebody else needs it. The people that are here to get as much as they can will take as much as they can. So it was one of those lessons that you kind of never forget.
As for being afraid amidst the violence and death, Sister Teresa Milne firmly says no.
I have received the gift from God of abandonment to divine providence. It means that every morning I say yes and thank you ahead of time for whatever you bring to me today. And because I had received that gift, that's what I said every morning. So I was ready to take whatever came every day. Nothing surprised me.
50 years later, both sisters continue to reflect on what caused the rebellion and how the city and nation can heal from decades of injustice.
I just think it was a deep wound that is still there to be healed because of the mistrust. And I think, the police department at that point was not always acting justly. And some of the same things we have in today's society, where there's brutality if you're black. I think the challenge was to do everything we could to eliminate poverty and to educate ourselves about what white privilege really means. I think we have no idea, just being white, what that means in our society. And right now, even with all the immigrant things that are going on, that if you are different, you are subject to all kinds of things that basically we wouldn't permit in our society. You know, like stopping. Every black mother has the speech with their sons about if you're stopped. No white mother does that. They don't worry about that. But every black mother has that speech for every son when he gets in the car.
The first challenge was to get them to try to see the causes of them. Always get at the root cause. If you can correct that, then the injustice goes away. But many people just sort of try to cut off that flowering dandelion at the top and don't see where the roots are or the causes.
I think we make pretty good attempts, but I think it's a problem that is a societal problem that no church can do it by itself, no one group. We all have to embrace our common humanity, that we are all equal under God and in the United States. And that's the dream. But we certainly don't practice it in many instances, certainly not in our justice system.
I have hope. I always have hope. I never think the negative, that it can't be done.
I just pray that that we would have a spirit of welcome to all people, no matter where they're coming from, what their origins are, what their wealth is, that we could accept each other just as we are as human beings.
Sister Teresa Milne, celebrating her 75th year as an IHM nun, and Sister Mary Ann Markle, both sisters in retirement now at the IHM Mother House in Monroe. An earthquake in Michigan? It may sound like a fake news headline you might read on social media, but Michiganders of a certain age may well remember this date in 1980. An earthquake centered in Kentucky hit Michigan. Witnesses across Michigan, including Allegan, Coldwater, Flint, Hastings, Mount Pleasant, watched vehicles rocking back and forth, dishes reportedly broken in Detroit, and perhaps quite scary, the earthquake also swayed Old Tiger Stadium's upper levels during the fifth inning of a game. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It launched in 1995 as an online bookseller. Today, Amazon's pretty close to its goal of selling us everything. Last month, it announced it's acquiring Whole Foods. Now we've learned Amazon could be planning to launch a meal kit service to rival Blue Apron. And the Amazon footprint in Michigan is growing. The Michigan Strategic Fund recently granted Amazon $5 million in state funds to build a second distribution center in Romulus. This is in addition to the distribution center it's building in Livonia. Both cities are in Wayne County. Amazon is promising some 1,600 jobs between these two centers. Stacy Mitchell's research suggests there could be a big price to pay for that. Her study for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance finds Amazon's net effect on the economy means fewer overall jobs. Stacy Mitchell's the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and she's with us now. Stacy, you focus your work exploring the true cost of mega retailers, in this instance, Amazon. How does building two distribution centers in Wayne County fit into what appears to be Amazon's strategy for expanding?
Amazon is rapidly growing across the economy. They are building distribution centers all across the U.S. They want to be as close to customers as they possibly can. And they're very interested in becoming really the dominant retailer in our society and also really owning the underlying infrastructure for much of commerce, the way we order goods online, how goods are delivered to our doorsteps, as well as the cloud. These are, you know, these big pieces of the economy that Amazon is really seeking to control.
And certainly distribution centers in Wayne County could mean clearly next day or perhaps even same day delivery for customers in Michigan, couldn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Now, Michigan gave $12.5 million in grant money to lure Amazon here. State officials say Amazon was considering building elsewhere instead. Is there any chance that that was a bluff by Amazon?
Amazon has to be near every major metropolitan area. They are going to build these distribution centers regardless. I find it outrageous that we've been giving so much public money to Amazon. You know, in the last 10 years or so, they've picked up over $1 billion in subsidies like this from local and county governments to fund the expansion of their warehouses. Amazon needs those warehouses in order to fulfill its vision. It's going to locate in these places anyway. Why are we giving them public tax dollars? And I think more importantly, in some ways, is our research has found that Amazon actually eliminates more jobs than it creates. So as it grows these distribution centers across Michigan, as it does more retail sales in Michigan, it's taking dollars out of existing businesses, and those businesses have to lay people off. We calculated that Amazon eliminates about 2 retail jobs for every 1 job that it creates in its warehouses. So this doesn't make a lot of sense to me from the standpoint of the state's economy.
And yet one of the reasons state officials say they like the Amazon deal is because of jobs, full-time along with the seasonal and part-time jobs as needed. That's what Amazon promised.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looks like they are creating jobs, but they're also eliminating jobs. And of course, it's much easier to see the jobs that they're creating rather than the many jobs that are disappearing at local businesses, brick and mortar chains across the state as they grow. But those jobs are very real. And there are a lot of people who are now facing the prospect of losing their employment. We've already seen tens of thousands of retail layoffs this year alone. And we expect to see more going forward. The impacts go even beyond jobs, though, because also at stake are a lot of small, locally owned businesses. And those businesses, they not only create jobs the way the big chains do, but they also give more money back to the state's economy. They're owned and rooted locally. They tend to buy a lot of goods and services from other businesses. You know, when they need an accountant, they're hiring a local accountant. When they need a website, they're hiring a local web designer, and so on. Locally owned businesses generate even more benefits beyond just the jobs. So there's a lot at stake here, and I question why a company that is sitting on an enormous pile of cash actually needs our public tax dollars, and also those dollars could be spent in much more fruitful ways in terms of creating good businesses and good jobs in the community.
Stacy, your report for the Institute for Local Self-Reliance that you co-authored, Amazon's Stranglehold is its title. And in it, you say Amazon strategically sells items and services at below cost to beat out competitors. So give us some examples.
Well, they sold books at a loss and still do by and large because they saw that as a way to bring people into their system, get them used to shopping on Amazon, and then ultimately be able to sell them other things. They sell a lot of things, at least in the short term, at a loss for in different kinds of scenarios. when they faced, for example, an upstart competitor online. One good example of that is Zappos, which is the shoe retailer, which was doing very well and really gaining ground online and beginning to rival Amazon in shoes. And Amazon systematically sold shoes at a loss to force Zappos into a difficult position, and Zappos eventually sold and is now actually owned by Amazon. Amazon does this with Prime as well. I mean, Prime, you pay $99 a year for Prime. It costs Amazon a lot more to give you all of the free shipping and the other goodies that come with Prime. But the reason Amazon subsidizes that is that they know that once you paid that $99, it's like a psychological trick. The more likely you are to shop on Amazon, because you want to maximize the value of that $99. You want as much free shipping as you can get. And what studies find is that people who sign up for Prime, they stop shopping around. They just start their search when they want to buy something online right on Amazon, and indeed spend about 3 times as much as non-Prime households. So Amazon's been very clever about this strategy of losing money in order to gain market share and get rid of the competition.
You know, talking about the promises of that Amazon made to hire some 1,600 full-time employees at the fulfillment centers here in Southeast Michigan, what did Amazon employees tell you about what it is like to work in these centers?
It is incredibly grueling work, very fast-paced, and you're very much expendable. So fulfillment center workers for Amazon, many of them are temps. Some are direct hires, but some are hired through subcontracted temp agencies. And you have a handheld device that directs you on where to go. And so you're always, you have a certain number of seconds to go grab the next item. So people are rushing around. There's a fairly high rate of injuries. And there's an enormous amount of churn. Most people don't make it through the first year being an employee there. And there's just an endless stream of people waiting to take your job, other people, other temps lined up, ready to come in. And so you have very little leverage to improve your conditions. It's very grueling. It's also quite low paid compared even to other similar kinds of warehouse jobs.
Now, your report really does, the title of the report really kind of sums up very deftly what's in it: Amazon's stranglehold, how the company's tightening grip is stifling competition, eroding jobs, and threatening communities. But, okay, Stacey, what do you say to people who say, look, Amazon Prime makes my life easier, I spend a few minutes clicking online, and what I need is on my doorstep? Why should I be made to feel guilty about that?
Oh, we're definitely not saying that anyone should feel guilty about that, but we are saying it's worth thinking a little bit more about Amazon's impact. You know, this is a company that in some ways has been visible, but it's also been quite invisible. I mean, it's sort of come into our communities rather stealthily. It's had a big impact on our economy, and people don't necessarily see it. It's very different from, say, when Walmart opens up a supercenter and everyone knows that Walmart is in town. Amazon is in all of our communities in a way, but we don't see it quite so clearly. So our report is really kind of lifting back that veil and looking at some of the maybe hidden consequences of that choice that are worth thinking about, especially if you want to continue to live in a place where people are able to start and grow a small business, where you have a thriving community center. There's a lot at stake here that's worth thinking about. But more importantly than that, our report really focuses on public policy. You know, Amazon has picked up these enormous public subsidies. They've benefited a lot from certain kinds of tax loopholes. They pay a federal income tax rate that's about a third as much as competing retailers pay because of those tax loopholes. They've benefited from lax antitrust enforcement that hasn't required them to treat, for example, all of the sellers that use their platform fairly. So there are a lot of ways in which public policy has actually supported Amazon's growth. And our big question with this report and our big assertion really is that those public policy choices have been misguided, and that we would be better off holding Amazon to a higher standard and having a more competitive economy, using those tax dollars in different ways, We're rapidly moving towards a situation where we have one retailer that controls online shopping. I mean, Amazon is already capturing one out of every $2 Americans spend. That's not competition, and we think the public policy support that is helping lead us in that direction really needs to be changed. So this is really a wake-up call as much for policymakers as consumers.
Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and co-author of the report, Amazon's Stranglehold. She was with us via Skype. Thanks so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Director Kathryn Bigelow's new film, Detroit, depicts one of the most horrific events of the 1967 rebellion, a night of terror at the Algiers Motel, a night that left three young black men dead at the hands of white police officers.
It's a war zone out there. They're destroying the city.
Whoa, hey, y'all seeing this?
Hey, look, we're not too far from the Algiers. Let's just go there till all this blows over.
Detroit had its world premiere this week at the Fox Theater, just blocks away from where buildings burned, bullets flew, and 43 people died. The gravity of what happened 50 years ago this week, very much on the mind of Detroit's cast and crew, along with their hopes for the kinds of conversations and thoughts the film might inspire. Oscar-winning editor William Goldenberg.
I've been doing this for probably close to 30 years, and this is the most emotional experience I've ever had cutting a film. I mean, the story is so tragic, and you feel so much for the characters. I hope people will start to, there'll be a conversation about violence as a whole, police violence and criminality, and treating police criminality the same as any form of criminality.
Actor Chris Chalk plays Detroit police officer Frank.
And so I hope that this continues an already slightly ignited conversation about race relations in America. I hope that people start to think about how we can transition to a government that is fair for brown-skinned people. Because if 50 years later we're still, you know, massacring a people, then we're not doing it right, you know. We're doing something very, very wrong.
Laz Alonso plays Congressman John Conyers.
It's a moment in history that so much was going on. Everybody felt like they had to be heard and they weren't heard. And I think that that's the really important part of this film, is what happens when people are just not heard. You know, even in today's time, you know, you see people talking at each other, but not with each other and to each other.
The lead singer of the soul group The Dramatics was at the Algiers Motel that deadly night, and that encounter with three vicious police officers left Larry Cleveland Reed with trauma that's lasted his lifetime. Saginaw native L.G. Smith plays this central character.
Every day was hard. I was on a production for a total of 3 months, and I was trying to get myself to the place where I kind of at least thought I felt like Larry was feeling. But I've never been through that type of brutality, so I had to take myself to dark places every day, thinking about family in ways I didn't want to think about them, thinking about things that I never want to think about ever again in my life, just to try to give this story to the world. But we held each other up as a cast. We prayed every day before the scenes. We made sure we told each other we loved each other after every scene, because we knew how serious this was. A lot of people don't learn this, so we hope to educate and also get empathy from people who don't understand why this happened. The people that look at this and say, well, why did those people burn the building down? And they didn't have to do that. When you're not being heard for hundreds of years, then what else can you do, you know? So
Hannah Murray is best known as Gilly on Game of Thrones. She plays Julie, one of two white teenagers beaten up by police that night at the Algiers.
Yeah, it was a very emotional set, and a number of our crew members said to me it was the first time they cried watching playback. And I think this is an important story. It's an important part of American history, but I think it's an important part of human history. And I think that the conversations that I hope this film can spark are conversations we need to be having as a global community.
Will Poulter plays Krause, one of three police officers who terrorized and killed the young people at the Algiers.
Now let's not be stupid in this situation. You need to tell me where the gun is. I got all night, people. Tell me exactly what is going on here.
I'm hoping we'll improve empathy, and I'm hoping we'll encourage discussion about racism, about race relations. I'm hoping that when invited, you know, everyone will participate in a conversation, that white people in particular won't run away from the topic. They'll address it. They'll come to terms with their own role in racial history, and they'll try and, when invited, become part of the progressive movement towards a future where everyone is a little bit more empathetic and understanding of one another.
Actor Ben O'Toole.
So I play the character of Flynn. I'm one of the three police officers that is effectively instrumental in the incident at the Algiers Motel. And he is morally questionable. I hope a lot of people are really uncomfortable. I hope it really upsets and really moves a lot of people. It's a hard watch. It's not an easy film to watch, but it shouldn't be either. This is a true story. Some of the most aggressive moments in this film are the truest, and they're the closest to the actual fact. So I want people to feel uncomfortable, because if we're uncomfortable, we'll do something about it.
Detroit opens here on Friday and will open nationwide August 4th. In 1967, there were dozens of uprisings in cities across the country, not just Detroit. President Lyndon Johnson created a commission to dig into the root causes of the unrest.
It will make recommendations to me, to the Congress, to the state governors, and to the mayors for measures to prevent or contain such disasters in the future.
Tomorrow on Stateside, Lester Graham explores why the Koerner Commission's findings were ignored. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.